Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with others and leave a five-star rating.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by five-time world champion, jump rope champion Molly Metz and her husband, Dirk Thompson. Thank you so much for joining Clause 8 to tell your story.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So Molly, you know, your story really could have been a story that the U.S. Patent Office could have been championing as this model story of this woman who reaches literally the top of her field, the world champion in her field, comes up with an invention based on her experience. The invention revolutionizes the sports of jump roping, revolutionizes the fitness industry. You start a company to make the product in the United States based on your invention because you think you can rely on the patent system. But before we get into that, of that alternate, let's go back to the jump roping part. How did you get into jump roping?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when I was 7, 8 years old, a jump rope team came to my elementary school and they did a performance. And I was the kid that was always outside playing sports, you know, throwing balls around. I just love sports. So when I saw the jump rope team, I was like, oh my gosh, this looks really cool, right? So I asked my mom if I could join the team. She said yes. And that's what started things off. The jump rope team is in Boulder, Colorado. And my coach is the founder of the sport of jump rope, which sounds kind of interesting. Yeah. So he was a PE teacher in Boulder, and he wanted to show the world that jump rope was more than just a playground activity, that it was a sport. So we would train at 4 a.m. in the morning, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You know, I'm just a little kid, and we were gearing up to travel the world and to kind of teach people that jump rope was a sport. So at a very young age, I was traveling and performing and primarily teaching the sport of jump rope. That's kind of where things got started. I just got totally hooked. I mean, what kid doesn't like traveling the world, not being in school and jumping rope?
Why do you think you were so good at it?
You know, I've just kind of been really savvy with sports my whole life. And so I actually don't even think I was that good to start. I think it's difficult. It was, you know, there's so much going on with jump rope. You have to be fast and you have the tricks and the choreography, you know, kind of like dancing. You have to work with a team. And so there was a lot of aspects of it, I think, that challenged me to want to stick with it and just keep getting better and better.
When you were a kid, did you think you'd spend your whole life kind of devoted to the sport?
You know, I thought I did. I think I thought jump rope was the only thing there was in life, you know, and I played other sports, but I was like, jump rope is the coolest thing. So, I mean, I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I think deep down I knew, but here I am today. Still, I have a jump rope company.
Let's jump forward. How did you end up coming up with your new invention related to jump rope? Can you tell us that story?
Yes. So in 2002, I had won my fifth world championship. The championship was in Belgium. I have to say that because Dirk is
from
Belgium.
From.
I just thought I'd say it. It's kind of ironic.
Is that how you met?
No. We met later on in 2016. So what? 14 years later. So after the fifth world championship, 2 years later, I was in a very bad car accident. I had hit some black ice. I sort of went off the road and my car went straight down. So I went up and through my windshield. I was knocked out. I broke my ankle in several spots, and I just really messed up my body. So being in a cast for a couple of months, you know, I went back to jump rope training, and I was a mess. So I started just analyzing my form and all the jump ropes that I was using and tinkering around with jump ropes. A friend of mine was helping me at the time, and it was about a year and a half of just messing around with jump ropes, playing with my form, and trying to get better and faster at what I do. I designed this jump rope handle for myself that sort of solved. I had some ideas in my head on things I wanted to solve, like a problem I was trying to solve with the jump ropes. And in any case, I created for myself a jump rope that solved those problems, and that's the jump rope that has the patents.
Can you tell us like a little bit about what the invention is?
Yeah. So what I was looking for at the time was, in jump rope, you can be a freestyle jump roper, which is crossing skills and gymnastics, or you can be a speed jumper and a power jumper, which is you just want to go as fast as possible. And that's sort of my thing. So I was looking for a jump rope that was going to take away the angle that the jump rope would have. So can I use a prop?
Yeah, sure.
So here's like a typical jump rope that would be for freestyle. See the cord? It has all this movement.
We should describe what you're doing.
Yeah.
For people who will be listening to it. But
so yeah. For people who aren't listening, just visualize a jump rope handle and a cord coming directly out of it. It's just kind of like old school, you know, being in elementary school. This is a typical jump rope that you probably used as a little kid. And so the cord has, you know, full ability to just kind of rotate around as much as possible. This is great for freestyle jumping, but I wanted to reduce that amount of movement. And I wanted the jump rope to be very fast. So what I did is I created a dual bearing system inside of the handle. I minimized the amount of movement that the cord would have. And then on top of it, which is kind of like the specialty piece, is there is, we'll call it a blade element accompanied with an articulating eyepiece. So the eyepiece is going to allow the wire to move with wherever your hand moves, right? So if my hand moves without the articulating eyepiece, the wire is going to have like, it's going to bend, right? And so instead, the articulating eyepiece that I put on there, so it's hard to see, but do you see, it's super, it's free, it's not going to bend, and it's very durable, right? And so that was another thing. All the jump ropes were breaking. I'd go through dozens and dozens of jump ropes a year.
You describe all of this, and there's a lot of so many aspects to it. If I decided to come up with a new jump rope, there's no way I could have come up with it because I don't have the knowledge or experience that I guess kind of
right.
you had from your life. Of
totally. But just like any invention, if you look at what I did, a lot of people are like, man, that's so simple. You know, but we can say that about anything that has been created or been designed. Or like you just said, people who are specialists or who are just, you know, focused on making these types of inventions, it's in hindsight, they look simple.
I had a past guest who said the best inventions are actually the most simple and elegant.
Right.
When you were going through this process and you said spending a lot of time coming up with the best possible jump rope, when did you start thinking about getting patent protection?
Right. So I started using my jump rope in practice, and some of the other jumpers were watching me and they're wondering like, where'd you get that rope? And I was like, I made it. And it just, I think just the idea of people in my sport being curious and saying, will you make me one? Kind of spurred in my mind, like, wait, I might be onto something here, you know? And I think at the time it was just, you know, the friend that helped me kind of come up with the idea. We said, okay, let's go get a patent attorney and see if this is, you know, a patentable idea.
Before we started this conversation, you know, I think you mentioned that not a lot of people know about patents or what the patent system is like. Mm-hmm. What was your impression of what a patent is or what the patent system was at that point?
If I put myself back in the time when we were going for the patent, I was convinced that they were going to say no, right? Because I thought patents were for really smart people, big business. And so I, you know, you just... you go into this process thinking, wow, like I'm going in for a patent and I don't know. And so that was my initial thought. But then as we were going through the process, I thought, wow, like this is cool. You know, like I'm kind of understanding it a little bit more. We're working directly with the attorney and the examiner and this whole process and, you know, kind of getting knowledgeable with that. And just realizing, you know, this, it took 4 years for my second one to come through. So it was a lengthy process. And then just kind of knowing as it was getting closer, you know, we got up the first one in 2010 and knowing that you had that support and protection. And even if your, you know, invention isn't going to be big, it's just it's a rewarding feeling. You just feel special. You have this ribbon and you're an innovator. You've created something. And I thought that was cool.
There's obviously interest in your jump rope. People are seeing you using it. You're going mm-hmm. through this process of getting a patent, and probably through this process, you actually see, wow, like this is something, what I have is really new, and maybe it's not the first jump rope in the world, but it's the first that jump rope in the world.
Right.
And the coolest. And,
Yeah. My question is, at a certain point, you started your company, Jump and Rope, to make the jump ropes in the U.S. Would you have started that company if you didn't think you would have patent protection?
No. So I had my company, Jump and Rope, but it was geared towards service. So I was working with kids. And so, yes, I would have had my company, but it would have been what it was at the time, that was working with kids in schools. I started to sell jump ropes when I got my patent in 2010, knowing I had protection, knowing this could be something that I could offer to the world. I started manufacturing and then opened my online shop, knowing that I had that protection and the patent. And just being, you know, here I am. I am the company with this technology. I have the patents and I get to offer this to the world.
Another piece to it is obviously a lot of manufacturers, even if you come up with an idea in the U.S., first thing that companies used to do is just say, well, who can I get it to make in China? Why did you decide to make it in America?
Gosh, I don't know why, other than why not. And I also just value, you know, made in America. I always have. Man, and over the last, you know, 12 years of doing business, I've had so many people come to me saying, you're wasting money. You're spending so much money on parts being bought in America. You could probably, you know, go to China and spend, you know, less than half of what you're spending here. Your profit margins could be better. And I said, I don't care.
And you know, it wasn't long before I think you've written about how hundreds of infringers were out there kind of copying your design, copying your invention. Can you tell us about when did you first start noticing that people were stealing your idea?
I'm going to say around 2011, I would see different, you know, fitness shops selling ropes identical to mine. The biggest indicator, like the biggest infringement I saw, and this is an interesting story. It was a company at the time called Again Faster. They were a CrossFit company, you know, selling, you know, all sorts of fitness equipment. And it was to a T, my technology, everything, right? I thought, how do they even get the mold, you know, to make this exactly the same? What I found out is that a jump rope coach came to Colorado, came to one of the tournaments that I had here, bought a bunch of my ropes, was very inquisitive about what I was doing. Anyway, a couple of months later, he starts an online shop in Arizona or New Mexico, and almost to a T copies everything that's on my website. And what he did is he took the product, he sent it to India, and a company called Sanguine in India starts manufacturing my jump ropes and then ships them over to America. So this Indian company was selling. So going back to that big company, Again Faster, that's where Again Faster was buying their ropes. So when I contacted Again Faster, I said, hey, you know, you're infringing. And they said, you're right. And they stopped. And that was one of my first big companies I started doing business. We would manufacture for them, do the pad printing, and then, you know, fulfill their POs.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So that's a company that kind of, I don't know if they knew about your patent or...
Who's to say if they knew or not, right?
Yeah, yeah. When you told them about it, they just did the right thing instead of...
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of my story, is that during that time in 2011 up to 2012, we would find instances of this, and these companies did the correct thing. They stopped, they either worked with me, and we made a deal. And it was during that time that I reached out to Rogue Fitness, who's kind of the bigger story at hand here. And they were the only company at the time that said, nope, we're gonna willfully infringe, talk to my attorneys.
So was Rogue Fitness already making your product, or you approached them to suggest making
it? We approached them. Okay. So I sent them my products and I said, rumor has it that you are interested in carrying my jump ropes. And he said, yes. I've been, you know, wanting to work, you know, I find out who you are and I'm glad that you reached out. Let's do a deal. So we started talking about how the licensing deal was going to look, kind of going back and forth if he was going to make them or if I was going to make them. And as that was going on, that conversation just sort of stopped. A couple months go by and then Rogue Fitness comes out with their launch of their new rope, and it was my technology. And so I write to Bill, the owner of Rogue, and I said, hey, I thought we were in negotiations. And his reply was, talk to my attorneys.
So at that point, when you were negotiating these deals, were you doing that personally, or did you have attorneys who were kind of
no attorneys? It was just personally. Yeah, I have all the emails, but there was no attorneys were involved.
So you seem like a very trusting person. Did you ever think like, well, Rogue could do what they did, just steal my invention, and like, what am I going to do then? Did that kind of occur to you?
Never at the time did it occur to me, because everyone else had obliged, and everyone was working with me and doing the right thing, honoring the patent, you know. Doing good business is, I guess, what I would call it.
So essentially, up to that point, the patent system was working for you. And then for whatever reason, Rogue, even though he seemed very friendly in the beginning, then he decided it would be cheaper for him, or whatever the reason is. Well, do you know why? Do you have any guesses about why he just didn't answer a licensing agreement?
Yeah, I mean, now that, you know, years have gone by, I can tell you that he didn't want to pay me. Because he sold millions of jump ropes. I think to him that was a better business deal. Did he know that at the time that was going to happen? I don't know. But I do know that when he launched his first jump rope, he had cartons of jump ropes that had come over from China. So he's a company that, you know, is made in America. They really push that to the community. But those jump ropes definitely came from China. I do have that in the emails. There was some discussion of him. I think he slipped up by saying, hey, I already have a bunch of jump ropes coming over from China. Maybe because I'm a woman. You know, I know that sounds interesting, but he had done some deals with some other jump rope companies, and they're all led by men. I don't know. I'm just throwing stuff out there. I don't know why he chose. I can tell you this, though. From 2012 on, every jump rope that he released had my technology on it. So that's a dozen jump ropes. Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned obviously Rogue Fitness. Everybody heard of CrossFit. Rogue Fitness is the largest distributor for CrossFit, as I understand it. And something happened where he was engaged in what seemed like a friendly conversation, but then he decided it's cheaper or easier for me to just infringe with patents, and went down the road and says, talk to my attorney. What did you do next? I said, when he said, talk to your attorney, what was your...
When somebody says, talk to my attorney, and they're that big of a company, I have this flashing of money signs going on in my head, thinking I'm going to have to get a bunch of money and a bunch of resources to fight these guys. So I waited. I thought, okay, I can't do this now. In 2012, I had just found a building here in my town, 10,000 square feet. I was renovating it. I had thrown all my resources into creating, you know, the nation's first jump rope gym. So my hands were quite tied. So I didn't do anything. And so for the next 4 years, I would watch Rogue release rope after rope after rope. And my consumer sales going down. You know, I think the perception in the community was, how come they get a steal? You know? And so some of the relationships that I had, you know, with the companies that were working with me, one backed out, you know, and they changed their jump rope technology, you know, so when an infringer infringes, it's not just them stealing your idea, but they're creating a big mess in the big scheme of things
Wasn't there like an instance where I think Rogue told someone that was about to license that they shouldn't license?
Correct.
Because your patents were no good?
Yeah. So a company had spoke to Rogue. It was buyjumpropes.net. I don't know if we can say all these names, but...
too late.
But we had spoke to the owner of that company. We spoke to the owner of that company. He said, well, no, Rogue said I can have this technology. It's okay. Who gave them the right to say that, you know? And it was causing a lot of problems.
You were savvy enough to know that to go up in patent litigation against a company like that would take an enormous amount of resources. I mean, were you talking to patent litigation attorneys at that point to kind of figure out how to make it feasible?
Yeah, that was in 2015. I decided I'm going to get some help and we're going to start small. So we didn't just start with Rogue. We started with, you know, there's 100 Amazon shops selling my jump ropes. So, you know, let's start here. Let's pick away. Let's, you know, get them off. Let's do some deals. I don't know if you knew this, but China was actually, you know, selling ropes into the U.S. So we were able to actually stop the Chinese ropes at the, you know, border or whatever that was from coming in here. So we really did our due diligence. You know, we were able to set up licensing deals. So again, going back to the patent was working. Our patent was valid. You know, these companies were obliging. We would go to court, we would settle, and doing all of this from 2015-ish to 2018. But it was in 2018 is when we served Rogue with infringement.
Up to that point, it still made financial sense for you to pay patent attorneys to kind of do all that from a business standpoint.
I mean, my rope was a commercial success. And I mean, at that point, you have to sign on to, you know, get those attorneys, trust the process, you know, and do the fight. I mean, anyone in my shoes would have done that. I mean, maybe not anyone, but that was my right. I'm the patent holder. I was told by the USPTO that I had the right to do that.
Finally, in 2018, you decided to go after Rogue, which was obviously the most notorious of the infringers. Do you mind sharing what did your patent litigation attorneys tell you about, like, how this would play out?
I would say that there was this sense of extreme confidence that we were going to have an easy go at this because of the years that we had spent already, you know, kind of shutting down everyone. And going into this, we just, I guess assuming is not a good word, but that once we served Rogue, that we would go to district court and, you know, the writing was on the wall. There was the emails, there's the dozens of jump ropes. I mean, it's just an obvious infringement. So it was just confidence. But the thing is, we never got our time in court, and that's what we're about to dive into, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is. And obviously the PTAB, that's a big part of your story. Were you aware of the PTAB at that point when you served Rogue?
I was not.
You filed a district court case, and Rogue filed a petition at the USPTO at the PTAB to revoke the patents. I guess, what was your reaction?
My reaction, I was completely naive at the time. You know, you got to put yourself in my shoes. I have one patent. My life has been directed towards coaching kids and athletes. I don't think of, you know, patent litigation. So my attorneys said, well, the case is going to be stayed and we're going to go through this IPR process. My biggest confusion was why is the validity of my patent now kind of the topic? But yeah, I had actually trusted, you know, when they explained what the PTAB was, I thought to myself, oh, this is no problem, right? We have a very good patent. So I just kind of trusted the process. Yeah. What were you going to say?
Well, yeah, it's like you have the bad guy, the infringer that steals your stuff that you bring in court, and then somehow they get to take the upper hand and decide what to do with the case and switch it around from an infringement case to you having to defend the validity of your patents or your claims.
But we are going back in time. I had full confidence in the system, in the idea of what the PTAB was. Even looking up what the PTAB was at the time, you know, go to their website. They're all about inventors, and we're for inventors. It's cheaper. It's a fast solution. And, you know, you read all these things, not knowing anything about it, you believe that. And so I trusted it all.
Turns out none of that is true.
So I think even in some of your... You've written about it and you've referred to the PTAB as a patent death squads. Judge Rayner first used that term. I mean, at that point, you didn't have any of this notion when you were going through the process.
Not at all. I was just so fixated on, we were in this infringement case and my infringer, I was so happy to just be at that point to, you know, get to tell my story, so to speak, of all the infringement they've done and have the jury and, you know, just to do all that. I was focused on that.
And, you know, we started this conversation with, you know, you're probably the world's foremost experts on jump roping. What did you think of Rogue's arguments in their petition to the PTAB? This is kind of the prior art. This is the obvious.
I thought it was ridiculous. I thought somebody had just dug up a bunch of mud and threw it at a wall. And, you know, you're reading this argument, and I just thought to myself, anyone that reads this is going to laugh. You know, You don't even need to be an expert in jump rope to know that what they had presented was just false. They were using ideas. First of all, they pulled prior art that I had already cited in my patent. And for anyone watching, if they don't know what that means, we can talk about that.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that point. So,
yeah.
And Dirk pointed this out. During the examination of your patent at the USPTO, during the process when you were applying for your patent application, the USPTO was aware of that same art that they were now citing during this PTAB proceeding. Yeah.
Yes. We've dug into this. We can't remember everything, but there is it's a no-no to present.
It's like rule 325D, I think.
Yeah. That you know, when you're the infringer, you need to come up with some new stuff, right? Let's get some things that really show that this patent is invalid, something that the examiner hasn't already looked at. They came up with a reason that this art was insufficient, let's say. And so you need a motivation to combine something with it. The motivation towards that prior art was not even in that prior art. And so they've made up this idea that this art has a problem on top of, you know, it was already cited in my patents. So there's more, but go ahead.
No, I think it's a good point. And I think either Dirk pointed this out to me or I read in one of your articles that the two patents that they ended up, the PTAB ended up relying on, one is from 1978, one is from 1979. So, you know, putting aside the legal stuff, putting all that aside, the argument I guess the PTAB accepted was there were these two patents around for about 30 years. Then you come there and it's obvious to come up with what you came up with. And then the hundreds of businesses start copying that. It's kind of absurd on its face if you don't have to be a patent attorney.
You don't even have to be a patent attorney.
They actually dated. So the problem in the primary reference that they, from the IPR, the problem that they came up with was something that they found in a patent of 1908. That's like over 100 years ago. Yeah. So they said, and the problem that they came up with, that one jump rope had that Molly supposedly fixed, had already been solved in 1908. Because they say, well, this rope here talks about a problem, and it had solved it by the use of a swivel joint. And that's why Molly went ahead and took a swivel joint, put it in this other rope, and fixed a problem that in this particular patent is never even discussed as being a problem. Which also brings me to the next point, which might be interesting to talk about. When the PTAB decided whether or not they wanted to institute, like take the case, they actually already said that this one patent does not have that problem, but yet they continue with it and they mentioned it multiple times after.
And it was part of their decision for invalidating patents.
I heard about your story. I read about your story, but came onto my radar again because I was reading Professor Dennis Crouch's blog, Patent Leo, which is one of the most popular blogs in the patent field. He's not exactly known as a champion of inventors. Like a lot of academics, I think it's fair to say that he's skeptical of many patents. But this is what he wrote about the decision in your case. The PTAB decision here is fairly questionable as applying hindsight bias and justifying combination of prior references. Still, the Federal Circuit affirmed without opinion. I'm not sure if he'd agree, but I think for him to say that, that's a very understated way of him saying the PTAB got it completely wrong. I've been reading his blog for over a decade, and I've never seen him kind of put it like that. He said the PTAB got it completely wrong, and the Federal Circuit just affirmed it. So you're looking at those arguments. To you, they seem laughable. But then it gets instituted. I mean, at that point, what were you thinking?
Yeah, when you say instituted, you mean that they invalidated my patents.
The PTAB wanted to take the case.
Oh, when they wanted to take the case.
Yeah.
I have to put myself back in the time. I just thought that was standard. I thought that they'd just take the... I thought that was what they did. They take the case. Come to find out, I think they take 70% of the cases, you know?
No, it's interesting. I actually looked up for the exact judge who was the author of that, your decision. She institutes 75% of the cases, and then she reverses herself 0.0 of the time. So once she decides to institute it, there's 100% chance that it's going to get invalidated. So it's funny because it's kind of going through this bizarro world where it gets instituted, but then you still have to present your arguments. But I guess at that point, you weren't really aware that it was kind of a game.
No idea. Again, naive at the time, thinking that this was just the process. Trust it. We're going to get through it. It's just the route that we have to take. So it's really, really unfortunate. For anyone listening too, when you get the IPR and they institute it, you have to hire an expert on top of your legal counsel. It was $150,000 to get this, you know, expert to peel apart your patent and then present, you know, to these judges why it's valid. It's just crazy to me.
You kind of had to do it for your business, but at any point did you think about maybe it's better to just give up?
Not at all. Once I'm in, I'm in. I'm all in. Even now, you may think I lost. I didn't lose. I'm still in. You know, everything in life happens for a reason. And
as Professor Crouch alluded to, the PTAB ended up invalidating your patents. You appealed to the Federal Circuit, and you got what's called a Rule 36 motion. And I'll read that decision in full. Affirmed, see Federal Circuit Rule 36. As a non-attorney, I guess, what was your reaction to seeing that kind of your life's, in some way, your life's work being decided in that way?
I was completely confused. You know, Dirk and I flew out to D.C. for that hearing at the Federal Circuit because, again, you know, going through the IPR, you know, getting their decision, and then our attorneys, everyone was just so confused. And we were like, okay, look, this appeal is what's going to finish it all off, right? The Federal Circuit is going to actually see, we'll call it the stupidity of this decision. So, you know, like we flew out and this is like you said, this is my life's work on the line. We're going to put all the good energy there. And our attorneys say, okay, let's wait 6 months now for their decision. To get that ruling 2 days later, oh man, I mean, it crushed me. Yeah. I just, and then on top of it to find out what that meant, which was they affirm, they don't agree, they don't disagree. And I'm thinking, how do they even know? It's been 2 days. Did they look at it? Are they too busy? You know, I mean, it's insulting.
No,
it's frustrating.
No one, I feel like all the APJs, the judges, they didn't look at it. They didn't read the patents.
Just for the listeners, you put judges in quotes.
Yeah.
Not my opinion, but I just...
like the APJs, the administrative patent judges, under quotes. Like, I've done some research, and I actually could pull it up on the screen, but I will spare you from that. I can show that they did not read the patents. Like, this one, let's say the Wolf patent, which is the primary reference that Rogue used to invalidate. The Wolf patent supposedly has a problem of winding and solves a problem of and has a problem of shearing, according to Rogue. And Molly, by taking the Wolf patent and taking another patent, Terper, combining both, she had solved both those problems. However, if you actually would read Wolf, the very first sentence says that this invention is a jump rope particularly made of steel. So then I'm thinking by myself, how would a steel cable jump rope, the steel cable, how would that start winding up on itself? It doesn't, it's steel. And the other thing is that the whole purpose of this invention, and he says it clearly, is to prevent shearing, meaning where the rope, when the rope comes out of the handle and it spins around, it usually would start breaking where it like cuts into the handle. And this guy has this invention where there's like a two-arm piece mechanism that comes out of the handle, and the rope doesn't ever even touch the handle. He fixes the problem, but yet the PTAB agrees with Rogue's expert, copy-pastes it in their final decision, and says that, yes, Wolf, Rogue is right, and Wolf has this problem.
We could do a whole other podcast on Dirk and the the decision of the PTAB. It really, I mean, it's a frustrating...
Then we go to the Court of Appeals, and we're like, finally, like, real judges that got sworn in by the president and confirmed by the Senate, they'll finally, like, we'll finally get this case looked at.
Somebody's going to oversee these.
3 days later, they didn't look at it, but yet they affirmed with the PTAB. So stupid.
You know, I was going to ask if the two of you ever disagreed about continuing this fight, but it seems like you're both of one mind about it.
Oh, man. I got to tell you, though, it's stressful. I mean, we get to a place where, you know, we're we're over it, but then we just look at each other and we're like, we can't be over this, right? I almost sometimes feel like the PTAB picked the wrong person to invalidate a patent. And I know this can take 20 years, and I'm going to fight for 20 years if it takes this. It's just
based on what we see in our case.
Yeah.
I can definitely say that the PTAB is getting sloppy, and they're, because I can show all these things, and I think we're actually going to make work of this in the future to expose this, so more people see this and know what the PTAB's really about. Because all we can see right now from USPTO and the leaders of USPTO is like, oh my God, look at this innovation, women innovation. We are here to support inventors. We're here to make change and to make America better. But they're not talking about the PTAB. They're not saying what the flaws are. They're not warning people about, hey, you should learn about this before you get a patent, because otherwise your patent, if we don't fix the foundation, your patent is not worth anything. There's none of all that. So yeah, we definitely have some fight left.
Actually, Professor Crouch's piece mainly touched upon your continuing legal battle to the Supreme Court. What do you hope to accomplish from that?
So our Supreme Court battle, I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but we just got an extension for
amicus brief.
How do you say amicus? Do you say amicus?
That's perfect. Yeah.
Okay. Amicus. We have three really good amicus briefs, but the appeal is really... I'm going to say it in the best way I can, and maybe Dirk can say it in another way. But basically, we went through the process. Our case went back to Ohio, and you know, one would ask the question: how do you, if you invalidate something that was once valid? We can all agree to that, right? Because if it has to be invalidated, it was valid, right? So we assume then that my patent has been valid since 2012 to 2021. So why is it that we can't go back to the case in Ohio with Rogue and get our time for infringement? Because that was a valid patent. You know, we should be able to look at that time and have that discussion about infringement from 2012, from the day they started infringing, to 2021 when there was a valid patent. That's the best way I can explain appeal. It's saying, hey, you lost your patents in a lower court with lower burdens of proof, and you never got time in court to look at the patent when it was valid. You have a better way of saying that. Is that an okay way of saying it?
What you said is interesting. Like, let's say Molly, often, like, we've met people. Amongst those people are people from the USPTO office of the Rocky Mountain Division here in Denver. We actually had them over at the gym to talk, and Molly starts feeling weird about the fact, okay, so now here I am. I have been taking licensing monies for X amount of years of all these companies, and my patents are not valid. So am I now a jerk for taking monies? Like, should I pay these people back? And the director of the division here, of Rocky Mountain Division, says, well, no, because from the moment your patents were handed to you until the moment they get invalidated, they're deemed valid. So you were lawfully entitled to receive those licensing fees. And then my question was to her, like, okay, well then you're telling me that from the moment you got the patent until the moment that the patent are invalidated, the patent's valid, right? She says, yes. I said, well, okay, well then how does that apply to Rogue? They've been stealing from 2012 all the way till now. It was valid and now it's not anymore. Shouldn't they be paying something? And she didn't really know the answer. But, to that point. But yes, the Supreme Court case indeed is, I think the main two words are like collateral estoppel, which means that if a case got decided at a court with a lower standard, like a lower burden of proof, which the PTAB is, then an Article 3 court with a higher standard of proof, they can't just cursorily agree with it. It's not the way to do it. So this is what happened in our case, and that's what we're fighting, which would ultimately result, with good hopes, that our case would go back to district court and we could go back to the infringement case that it first was. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't revive the patents. I think those are gone forever, but at least it's a good start.
And it could change the course for other inventors who have gone through this.
You went through a process. There's a new director's review at the USPTO because of other Supreme Court decisions. I mean, what do you think about that? Is that a good thing for other inventors? But at least there's a director review now.
I just think there should have been a choice. You know, when I serve the infringer and we get to district court, I think back before 2012, bringing up validity of your patent and infringement was great. You could do that both at the district level. You know, what happened to that? What happened to choice? You know, I just...
Yeah, like you as a patent owner that got things stolen from you, you don't get the choice.
There's
to stay in court. But however, the bad
against,
guy gets the choice to take you out of that court and buy himself in with by paying off a fee, he gets to buy the court with the lower standard, which is the PTAB. It's what happened to that choice? So director review, I think it's something, but I would prefer staying out of the PTAB.
Right. Staying out of the PTAB would be ideal.
I want to discuss something I guess Dirk kind of alluded to about the this administration, their biggest goal related to patents publicly is kind of to increase the number of women inventors and the number of women who are filing for patent applications. There was a meeting that you wrote about in IP Watchdog. It was called USPTO Stakeholder Listening Session. It was in Silicon Valley, and they had the director of the USPTO and various academics. Why did you decide to virtually attend that meeting, and why did you decide to write that article?
I decided to write that because I had high hopes for the new director. I thought that there was some interesting things said on that panel and that discussion. I joined because I'm just trying to get more educated on what's happening. And in June, I had watched that, and I thought, okay, I'd like to meet Kathy Vidal, the director of the USPTO, at some point. And she seemed like an advocate for change. You know, maybe she would be willing to look at my case, peel it apart and start making some changes, you know, for the future inventors. And so that's why I wrote that article. I've shifted gears a little bit since then, but...
Actually, it's a new council, I guess. They call it Council for Inclusive Innovation. It's chaired by the Secretary of Commerce. It's the vice chair is the USPTO director. But after you wrote your article kind of indicating your desire to work together to improve the patent system, did somebody contact you from the administration to kind of get your thoughts about how they can increase diversity and innovation?
No, nobody contacted me. The only people who have really contacted me from the outside have been other inventors who have been hurt by the system. But getting through to the USPTO has really been on our end, you know, kind of knocking on the doors there. So I actually, after that article did that, I really wanted to have a meeting with Kathy Vidal. And I've had that. Yeah. So that was just recent. What was that? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Maybe 3 weeks ago. It doesn't matter.
About 2 weeks ago.
That was a big deal for me to have set that up and to spend the money to get out to DC and to meet her. And my feedback to that meeting is, one, I was disappointed. I think that I'm inconvenient to her. My story is inconvenient to her. I think that the things she wants to do for the patent system, why they might be true, they might just be a bunch of words right now. I don't know. That's just my feelings from the meeting. She doesn't seem to want to look at my case, to talk about my case. I'm in the past, and whatever she's going to do is going to just be for the now. And I don't know. I'm a doer, you know, like I'm an action person. I'm not big fluffy in the front with marketing and words. You know, in fact, I don't need to say anything. I'm just going to take action. I'm going to do it. And I guess I'm at that point with her. It's when I see some action and perhaps I'll change my mind again. But right now I just hear a lot of big things.
So what was her reaction to kind of hearing your story? Even if you putting the legalistic parts of it aside, I mean, it's hard to deny that you're somebody who kind of devoted your life to this invention. I mean, what was her reaction to hearing, I guess, your story?
Gosh, cold. I don't think there was a reaction. I think she just sat there with a blank face and...
She did a lot of yes and mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, I wasn't there to say, oh, poor Molly, and, you know, I'm so sorry. I expected more. I expected
It was very short.
Yeah, just acknowledgement. Very short meeting.
There was some other people on Zoom on the screens, and it wasn't 100% focused on you.
Yeah, but no follow up. It just was cold. I'm just disappointed. What were my expectations? I guess I just, again, thought that she was going to want to sit down and discuss the things that went wrong and be open to just looking at the big picture. And there was none of that.
Did any of the academics who were on the panel who are say they're interested in increasing the number of women in innovation, did any of them contact you to get your thoughts about how they could do that?
No.
And I just want to put for the record, one of the academics who was on that panel, she's hosting a conference, the Case for Diversity, Innovation, and Inventing. Almost all of the speakers are other academics or patent attorneys who work for companies who are known to infringe a lot of patents. It's an interesting choice. I'm sure they saw your article. In fact, I think some of the comments that I've heard since then kind of point to the fact that they don't like you sharing your story. It's inconvenient for them, I think, the way you put it.
It just really is. And I'm sorry it's inconvenient for them. I mean, life presents some, uncomfortable things. But at the same moment, when life presents these things, let's sit down, let's listen, let's pick it apart, and let's make some changes based on this big fault that we see here. I mean, at least that's how I operate. And I'm sorry they're uncomfortable, but you guys just ruined my entire world over here, with a lot of false promises, I guess we'll call them,
So I obviously value your opinion a lot. So maybe we can help them this, and I want to try to do this. The statistics they point out are pretty stark. Women represent 50% of the workforce and only 13% of inventors. Molly, why do you think that is? Why are women not more excited about the patent system?
I mean, maybe there's just not a lot of women business owners anyway. That's a really good question. I don't know. I have to think about that. Do you know? I'm a woman. I own a business. I mean, it's hard. I mean, anyone, woman or man, it's hard to own a business. It just is. I mean, it is a 24-hour job. You're always thinking about everything. You're responsible for everything. You're responsible for all the decisions. Having the patent, going back in time when I got the patent and I opened my shop and then having infringers, I mean, that's just a whole nother level of emotional, load. And maybe women are actually intuitively smart and they know not to get a patent because they know it's going to be full of a lot of extra hard work. I mean, it just has been. I mean, it's been really, really difficult. It's hard to have something. It's hard to have a commercial success. Everybody wants it. Everyone's going to steal it. And that's why we have patents. And that's why we have our patent system, right? To protect that.
The position is your stories like you telling your stories just discouraging other women inventors from applying for patents. Do you think she has a point? Or do you think there's a point to that? And
is there a point for her to push for women innovators?
No. Is there a point to saying you sharing your stories about how the patent system didn't work for you is going to discourage other women inventors?
I think that it will discourage other inventors. I don't want it to. I mean, I want to be an advocate for innovation in our country, and I want to be an advocate for patents and for women business owners and for women to have patents. I one day will be back there when things get fixed. But as things stand now, I don't think it's wise to get a patent, especially if you're going to have a commercial success.
Yeah, they first need to fix the problem before they push people into owning patents. They first need to fix the foundation of the problem, because otherwise, to me, I'm not saying it is, but to me, it just looks like a scam. Like if you're telling people, hey, you have to get this patent and we're supporting you with your innovation, and on the other end, it's just a machine that takes people's monies in form of fees and then spits them out at the other end at the PTAB and it's worthless, then why pushing it? It's just a waste of everyone's time, money, and it's kind of dumb. And then coming up with the excuse like, well, let's create a PTAB because there's a lot of bad patents out there. It's also lies and untrue. Actually, if you have time, go on the Google Wayback Machine and go to the old USPTO website and try to find some press releases in 2007 and 2008 of the fiscal year end results, how they boast about the quality of their examinations. They boast about quality everything, quality patents. They're talking numbers, 96.5% quality compliance in examining and consequently the issued patents and trademarks. So it's, to me, it just seems like a scam. You're telling people like, hey, you're going to get this highly qualitative shiny object, but then when you actually get it, they don't even help you. They don't even protect you while you're being spit out at the other end, and it's so-called worthless and it's a bad patent.
And I think to Dirk's point, for anyone listening, is there was a narrative that was created in 2012 that there was patent trolls. And that was a clever way, you know, for big tech and those who really wanted the AIA bill to pass to kind of put this idea out there that, wow, there's all these bad patents, there's these patent trolls, we need to get rid of them. And point is that, again, if you go to the USPTO website, like Dirk said, here they have this 95% compliance, great patents. You know, it's just contradictory. And basically, the narrative of patent trolls is wrong. It's not the truth.
Dirk, you mentioned you need to fix the foundation. I mean, if Molly and Dirk, if you had a magic wand, what's your one idea for improving the patent system? What would that be?
Go back to pre-AIA. Before 2012 and the bill passed, I think that the patent system worked well. I think going to court, a district court, you know, having due process, a jury, a judge, you know, clear and convincing evidence. I just think that worked. And if it took a long time, it took a long time. Somebody like me, I'll spend 10 years fighting my case as long as I know I'm going to get a fair process. And I don't like being told, hey, we're going to put you through this other process. It's faster. It's cheaper. You know, and for those listening, it was 4 years. It was $500,000 and I have no patents. That's not faster, cheaper. And I'm left with nothing.
And
no due process. So anyway, it was a long-winded way of saying what would I like? I'd like to go back in time and I'd like to go back to when it worked.
Yeah, or at least flick the magic wand and make the PTAB optional, like a choice for inventors, and ask us if we want to go there or not, but not force it upon them.
So let me, I guess, play the devil's advocate for a second and say, all right, Molly, let's assume what happened to you is wrong, as Professor Dennis Crouch has suggested. The PTAB got the wrong decision, but there's surely a lot of other inventors who the patent system is working for, and you're just not hearing from them. So what do you think about that argument? Do you think it's a realistic response?
No, I mean, I would say bring those people on. Let's talk to them. I'd like to hear who those people are. Do they have a commercial success? I mean, my patent was working for me, you know, for some time. And when you try to shut down small companies who don't have the means to go through to the PTAB, sure, the patents are working for us. But when you have a big success like I did, and you have an infringer who has millions and millions of dollars, the patent system is not working for those people. So, I mean, I guess that's my response to saying that the patent system works for those who have a product that is not out in the world.
Too successful.
And successful, yeah. So, yeah, and there's a lot of patents like that. I mean, mine could have been that way too. And I would have just been saying, oh, my patent works because, I don't know, it works.
Molly, you mentioned like a lot of inventors are obviously reaching out to you for who the patent system does not work. Mm-hmm. Have you heard inventors reach out to you and say, oh, look at me, it actually worked perfectly for me? Have you had anybody reach out to
not
you?
Not one. I would love, I don't know if you don't know me enough, but I'm a very fair person. I love both sides. I'm not like a person who needs to be right. And I would love, I mean, if there's somebody listening who can call me and tell me how it worked for them, I'd love to hear that. I just would. So whoever you are out there.
I guess it's an open invitation from Molly and myself as well. If you have a story to tell about how the patent system is working for you really well for an independent inventor, I'd love to tell that story as well. We'd all like to find out about it.
We would totally love that.
There probably are some if they get to deal with people that are actually normal and good people and that conduct good business and that actually want a license.
But I think what he means is that maybe has it worked for them in the sense of have they sued an infringer like Rogue gone through the system, went through the PTAB, and it all felt correct to them. Mm. Right?
I'd like to know, too.
Because prior to suing Rogue for infringement, I mean, I want to go back in time sometimes. I mean, this makes you mad, crazy mad sometimes. You know, I'll be up at night and I'll be like, if we would have just not served Rogue, right? We were doing great. We had licensing deals.
But then what's the point of having a patent if you can't enforce it?
Right. And then I go back and I'm like, well, if I knew all this about the PTAB at the time, I was actually forced to serve them with infringement, because you have X amount of years from the date that you know that they started infringing to serve them. And so my time, I couldn't sit on that, you know, even if I wanted to.
What is your advice to somebody? Let's say there's another woman entrepreneur out there who has a patent, who might have some small licensing deals, but she knows there's a big infringer out there and she's thinking about suing them. What would your advice be?
I actually have somebody like that right now, and she just got, she's been threatened by the biggest company who she wants to sue. Because for the listeners out there, you don't have to sue somebody to go down the IPR channel, the PTAB. Your infringer can actually IPR you anytime they want. So it can become a big threat as a patent owner, and it's intimidating. And so this particular friend that I know has been kind of like, at any time, you guys, I can be IPR'd. I have to shut my mouth, because if I bring up any kind of, I want to do a licensing deal, anything, she'll be in big trouble. And so she just got IPR'd a few months ago. So my advice, I don't know if it's advice other than just hang on. You know, the world needs to hear about this. There's a way to fix it. You know, it's the little guys against the big guys in this case, going to Congress, getting a good bill to pass to make some changes. There's the Thomas Massey bill out there right now that totally gets rid of the PTAB. I think that might be a little bit too much for Congress to kind of say, we can't drastically take this away. However, in 2012, they drastically introduced it. And so, you know, this happened to me for a reason. My story is simple. My technology is simple. People can understand it. And I think it starts here. I think we need to wake people up to this problem. And it's bigger than just little inventors. You know, our own country is in trouble. You know, we need competition. We can't just have big business. We want little small businesses to thrive. You know, Google once was small. They had patents, which actually got them to where they are today. And we need to remember that. So I guess, again, my advice is just to hang on and to speak up too, right? And to tell your stories. And I think they're afraid to tell their stories, because if they tell their stories, you know, their infringers are going to get upset. You know, it's a tough place to be. I feel like my mouth has been shut closed since 2012. There's a lot of, you go through this process of, well, if I say something on social media, I might be, you know, causing some sort of trouble down the road when I do sue them. Or you're just put in a corner. It's a nasty place to have to be. So I have nothing now. I have nothing to lose. I can say whatever I want. Right. I mean, I'm at this point where I hope I can inspire others to tell their stories. And every other day I get somebody who emails me, calls me, and, you know, doing these podcasts, like, it would be so cool if you could get one inventor every week. You know, you'd probably do that for the next 10 years. And that might wake our country up to.
It might be a little, depressing. Maybe for my too. Listeners.
I know. It is depressing, though. but we don't want that.
Yeah, I guess if listeners could see it, you two seem such happy people after going through so much. It's incredible to see your optimism and your passion for helping, I guess, other innovators and other entrepreneurs. It lifts your spirits in some ways.
Yeah, and we are happy people. We have our gym here in Colorado, and I think that's what's kind of keeping us going. You know, moving your body keeps you happy anyway. I definitely have my hard days where I just, you know, go to bed and cry all day. And that's okay. You know, we do this as humans, but I can't do that every day. And we have to keep fighting. I don't know. This is like in the movies, right? The little guy, he's got to keep going. This is what we're going to do. And the happy part, we have to stay happy. Otherwise, we're just going to get angry and sad. And then we can't help.
And I think it's a good moment to end. But Dirk, Molly, is there anything else, I guess, you want the listeners of Clause 8 to know?
I think everyone listening needs to get a jump rope and jump up and down a lot because it makes you happier. So that would be my final.
And a jump and rope, right? That's the...
Yeah, my company's Jump and Rope, if they want to visit it and check things out. Yeah, Jump, the letter N, rope, yeah. But it truly does. If you look it up, jumping up and down just in general makes people happy. So just, they should get up right now after they listen and just start jumping around and remind themselves that it's...
I would say if there's anything I would like them to know is like that what we just talked about, you're just scratching the surface of what's going on with the patent system. And anyone like who has not had the moment where you had an idea, like anyone that ever has had an idea should probably take some time and look up some stuff about this, because it's pretty dramatic and people should get educated about it and be sure that they know what's going on just for themselves and for the sake of the country.
And the history of patents in our country, I think that's really actually an exciting topic, you know, to read about how innovation made our country to be what it is today, you know, and that we're losing that. So maybe people don't care. They should. But I think it's an exciting thing about our country. So,
well, thank you, Molly and Dirk. And as you said, I think you've been wanting to tell the story for the last 10 years. We wish it had a different ending, but you're going to continue to fight, and maybe one day that movie will be made about when the outcome we kind of all hope for. Thanks again for doing the Clause 8.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having us today.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.